get you 450 miles on one tank of gas. I've done it multiple times on my 1999 Toyota. 450 miles on one tank of gas. You compare that to 40 miles on one charge of batteries. That's a more than a 10-to-1 difference. That's not easy to live with. And when I go that 450 miles, I can recharge that energy device called fuel tank in a couple of minutes at a gas station. It takes you a lot longer to pour that energy back into that battery. So we got a ways to go yet. K2KEY, K2RIW.
62QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that I've been noticing so far is the batteries. As far as Rojas and batteries, when you go to nickel metal hydride or the lithium ion batteries, there's no lead in them, and they don't contain any of the materials for Rojas, so they're okay. And as far as automobiles, some of the things I've been hearing and seeing some of the developments on, certainly not ready just yet, but is the hybrid combinations of batteries and fuel cells. And it's absolutely phenomenal, some of the stuff. You know, a lot of the stuff is still under sheet so far, but I think when some of the stuff starts getting released, we may start to see some companies here on Long Island offering cars that pretty much don't require any gasoline at all. Very amazing, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Okay, if I had a fuel cell automobile, and if the raw fuel that the fuel cell ran on was the oxygen that's contained in the air, plus the hydrogen that's in my tank, because it is so darn difficult to store hydrogen, to get 400 miles of range out of hydrogen in the tank being used to a fuel cell, that's a tough combination. And even if you did have reasonable range with the hydrogen, and I say storing high-pressure hydrogen is tough, where's the hydrogen going to come from? Well, you're going to burn petroleum to get the energy to do the separation of water into oxygen and hydrogen to get the hydrogen. So although it sounds good, the difficulty of getting the fuel for a fuel cell is still a bit of a difficulty as I see it. Back to you, Glenn.
Hey, good guy.
Eric, right after Glenn. Glenn first.
Well, actually, from what I've seen so far, I'm probably not at liberty to say what is actually going on, but the implementation is probably going to be natural gas. And there's a synthesis that provides fuel directly to the fuel cell. But very, very impressive. And I said, keep your eyes open, because eventually this stuff, it's going to make it to the market, or at least it's going to come out very, pretty shortly. KC2QIQ, Dick, I guess, hand it over to Eric.
On a quick break, Glenn, make me a guess. Is that a year away or 10 years away?
Dick, I've seen it right now. I've seen people working on it. I would just say as soon as possible. And there again, I'm probably not at liberty to say either.
Okay. Eric, you're a guy who drives a real hybrid automobile. You've been there. You've done it. Tell us about it. K2EJ, K2LIW. K2LIW, K2EJ.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, you know, fuel cells are all nice and dandy, except that they have a limited life, which nobody talks about. Well, let me turn that down. They only operate for X number of hours, depending upon the amount of platinum catalyst you put in the fuel cell. And we're talking about PEM membrane fuel cells specifically. The other kind can be quite a bit more dangerous. What NASA uses is actually an alkaline-based fuel cell that runs off of potassium hydroxide, the catalyst within its system. So, not for the average consumer, so to speak. As far as storage technology, if you remember the last time we had this conversation, let me know the drop. We were talking about Oshunsky's bottle, which was about 150 miles worth of hydrogen storage. So either internal combustion using hydrogen or fuel cell. And he's come up with some, his wife died, and he decided that he was going to, you know, dig a little more into his inventions. And it looks like they're coming out with like a 250-mile model that low pressure is a metal hydride of his specific formulation that, of course, absorbs hydrogen in free space, and it releases it. So that technology is coming along. The big deal is membrane fuel cells having a restricted life, actually, and they're kind of expensive to replace. That's one thing. Although they talk about, you know, mass manufacturers dropping the price, but still raw materials. If we're talking about Iceland, where it's all going to begin, because they generate their electricity geothermally, having a water disassociation station at every corner is a feasible thing. Not quite nearly as feasible here if you consider the amount of power that it takes to run one of those things. Just to fill up a tank, you start scratching your head and say, if I'm doing it from fossil fuel, where's the efficiency? K2RIW, K2J.
When it comes to a hydrogen bottle type fuel tank, how fast can I recharge it? Or do I consider that a module and I just exchange modules at the gas station? How does that work, Eric? Go ahead.
Now, if you've ever seen them fill up a natural gas vehicle, similar, it takes about 3 or 4 minutes. The stuff absorbs rapidly. It's not like you have to wait a half hour or something like that. The only thing that I can think of these days where a changing of a module would happen would be in a zinc air battery. Because as you know, you can't reverse charge it the way you can discharge it. But not to this day, still has the highest number of watts per square inch of all types of batteries. But, there's a couple of companies working on making it an efficient type of, quick exchange. You pull into the station, you drop a module in, pull the old module out, drop a module in, and you've got another 400 or 500 miles of juice.
So you're telling me that a zinc air battery has multiple times the energy of a lithium ion battery or a lithium polymer battery?
Absolutely. I think it's 6 times to 8 times the density. It's a combination of the number of joules stored in a particular weight of material versus its specific density. It's molar density. It holds a heck of a lot more energy. I mean, that is really the best battery technology that we have, but it's not like you can feed fuse back into it, so it doesn't make it good for regenerative braking or anything like that.
Uh-oh, I know there's a problem. Alrighty, I knew there would be a problem. So zinc air, I think you're going to tell me not much manufacturing has occurred, therefore it doesn't have the economy of scale. It's probably an expensive battery. Maybe it's got a high internal resistance. It doesn't like being recharged with dynamic braking. And maybe you can recharge it, but you've got to do so very slowly over a long period of time, so you're changing them in modules. Is this approximately where we are with the zinc air battery?
Yeah, it is. Actually, the manufacturers in large quantities for military, they use them in some vehicles which have high power electric systems where they don't want to have to carry additional diesel fuel. It's out there. I think the batteries are on the order that they make for the military. I saw one, a picture of one a couple months ago. I think it was something like, it was a relatively small case. Produces something like 600 amp hours at 48 volts.
Any idea what the price of that thing was?
When you say military, you're going to have to multiply the price by 10, but I really have no idea, but I'm sure it's up there somewhere.
Do you have a prediction that could become a consumer product for the automobile you and I drive 5 or 10 years from now?
I would say that's a possibility. It's not the most efficient way of doing things because the plates are regenerated by a chemical deposition process, which really quite a vision, but it does take a long period of time. So there's not a lot of wasted energy in regenerating that battery, and you're not moving chemicals in and out of the air because they're captured within the plate. So I think it's feasible, but then again, you know, you can actually go out right now and buy a hydrogen-powered UPS for your computer or your house, or even, believe it or not, broadcast cameras. They have these little bricks, and they look like little CO2 cartridges that are filled with hydrogen. That'll give you like 8 hours of power in your camera while your back gets wet from the water dripping.
How about that? In the case of a zinc air battery, do you have to disassemble it in order to recharge it, or do you recharge it in a conventional manner, but just very slowly? How do you recharge a zinc air battery, Eric?
Well, from the things that I've seen, it essentially looks like there's really two different sets of plates that with air in between them. And essentially, one module is a series of plates that you're pulling out. And that gets put in another device, which does the redeposition by moving electrons from one part of the plate to another.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is you have to disassemble the battery in order to recharge it. And if you just simply pump current back into it, somehow it protests. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, well, the concept for, you know, the commercialization of it is that, you know, it's essentially a black box that fits inside another black box. You pull the black box out, and when you drive into the gas station, you drop another black box in and leave them with the black box, which gets collected and then recycled.
And it's a factory recycling. I guess they would call it an O-level, a factory-level refurbishment required. Not done in the field, a little bit on the exotic side, but a lot more energy density. It pays you money, it takes your choice. We got a ways to go. I sure wish we were free of petroleum dependence on foreign governments. How we have tolerated 60% of our oil being imported, and all the risk and bloodshed that creates, and the gnashing of teeth. Oh well. Now, time to go on to something more pleasant.
K2KEY, K2LAW. KEY, yeah. You can go on with this subject indefinitely. There's so many facets to it. All right, I'm just reading over. Here's one from a listener. Last week, you fellas were discussing vacuum tubes. We were talking with Rich, I think, about tubes, because we mentioned transconductance. What is transconductance, and how do you measure it? I'm curious, because I do have some old radios and equipment that have vacuum tubes, and I'm very curious what exactly were you talking about. I just never heard the terminology with vacuum tubes. Well, this is something that tells you your age about tubes, and the intricacies of tubes, and one of the buttons of a tube is its transconductance. You want to say a few words on it first, Dick? Go ahead.
Yes, I do. When it comes to modern day amplification, say for instance a operational amplifier, and a Grutt ordinary operational amplifier these days usually has 100 decibels of gain. Let me choose one with 120 decibels of gain. A 741 op amp, on average, has 120 decibels of gain. In that case, it's a voltage gain, voltage in versus voltage out. If I, in theory, have 0 volts across the two input terminals, I'll get 0 volts across the output terminal on a good op amp. Put 1 microvolt positive across the input terminal, and because it's usually used as an inverter, I'll get -1 volt output. So a microvolt of input creates a volt of output. You and I would call that a voltage gain of 1,000,000 to 1. Microvolt makes a volt of either polarity. And when I convert a million to one voltage by the formula 20 log of V1 over V2, V out over V in, it's 120 decibels of gain. So that's an op amp, that's voltage gain. If you take a look at the tube curves for a pento tube, you'll discover that the curves show you a bunch of almost horizontal lines, and each one of those horizontal lines has a particular grid voltage on it. The bottom line will be at minus 8, the next line up will be minus 7, the next line will be minus 6. So for each volt that you put into the grid of the tube, you get a certain amount of current coming out of the plate of the tube, almost irrespective of what voltage is on that plate. It's almost a pure horizontal line on that curve. So voltage in creates current out. That's not voltage gain. That's not current gain, because you're not putting in current. It's a voltage to current conversion with gain. They gave that a name, transconductance. Voltage in, current out.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Now, if I was rating a resistor, and you pick up something called the 1-ohm resistor, by Ohm's law, I put 1 volt across it, it draws 1 ampere. So I could say R equals V over I. If I get that right, or is it I over V? If I make the R bigger, yes, R equals V over I. Voltage over current equals resistance is the equation for a resistor. However, in the case of a tube, it's not voltage over current, it's current over voltage. For whatever voltage I put in, that's the denominator, I get a certain amount of current, that's the numerator of the equation. It's upside down of ohm. It's measured in mho. M-H-O is ohm backwards. So if I got upside down ohms, conductance instead of resistance, we call it mho. And resistance has a duality called conductance. And what the tube is doing is a transit situation. In other words, you put something in, you get something out. Part of why they call it transconductance. And it's rated in mohs or micromohs. So a 1-mho tube would draw 1 amp when you make a voltage change of 1 volt. 1 mho is also 1,000 millimohs. So they have to get used to these units. Because tubes are not as popular, you don't hear transconductance as much. You can buy operational amplifier-like devices which do operate like a tube. You put volts in, you get currents out. And they also make the opposite kind. You put currents in, you get volts out. They make op-amp-like things, and by adjusting the resistors in the circuit around the op-amp, you can create any one of those devices you like. You can create with an op-amp a beautiful constant current generator, a constant voltage generator, a voltage-controlled current generator, a current-controlled voltage generator. You can do anything you want if you're smart enough with op-amp. They got a lot of capability. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I've been asked this question before. Basically, I think I explained it a little different. Maybe it's a little easier to understand. Transconductance. Every tube has transconductance. And you look on a data sheet of every tube, you'll see transconductance. And usually, you'll see it indicated as a little GM, like a little lowercase GM. That's the symbol for conductance, this little G. And basically, as Dick says, the conductance basically is the reciprocal of resistance. In other words, opposite of a resistance is conductance. So if you have a situation like this, it's like how much the circuit is basically how much the circuit is resisting the flow of electricity. And the G, or the conductance, would be the measure of how much it doesn't resist the passage of current. So far, am I doing it right, Dick? Over.
Yes, you are. More conductance for the same amount of voltage means more current. Conductance is 1 over ohm. It's the reciprocal. Or 1 over conductance is ohms, or 1 over ohms is conductance. And so we often talk about the impedance of a circuit, and if it's a complex circuit, when it's got resistance and reactance, we call that R plus X. But you can also talk about the admittance of a circuit. It's 1 over impedance, which consists of the equivalent in resistance, called conductance, 1 over R, and the equivalent of reactance, which is called susceptance, 1 over reactance. So there's a bunch of duality in circuits, and when you flip back and forth between impedance equations and admittance equations, when you're working with a ladder network, you use the impedance when you've got a series component, you use admittance when you've got a parallel component. Just memorize that. I know it's not the whole answer, but when you hear it enough times, it'll eventually start making some sense. But every resistor has a certain conductance. A 10 ohm resistor is a 0.1 ohm conductor, a 0.1 mo conductor. 1 over 10 is 0.1. A 100 ohm resistor is really a 0.01 conductance. Maybe that helps a little bit. Over to you, Mel.
Maybe I better explain that a little slower, Dick, because we're going to surely get letters, as they say. And Dick was just saying, a poor, let me put it in another word, a poor conductor has low conductance and high resistance. I'll say that again. Poor conductor would have low conductance and would have high resistance. A good conductor has the opposite. So Dick was just saying a 10 ohm resistor would have a conductance of 1 over 10, and he said MHO. MHO is ohm spelled backwards. And MHO is actually the symbol for the G, or it is the, what we use the G as for conductance. So if I have a, for instance, a 1,000 ohm resistor, it would be 1 over 1,000 MHO, would be 0.001. So basically, it's I guess it's a little crazy to work with, but when the MHO, as Dick was saying, it gets large, so now we're getting into what you will see in many of the specifications of milli-HOs or micro-HOs. I think, before I go any further, am I putting it in the right word? Dick, over.
Very, very close. Milli-mo or micro-mo. Milli, M-I-L-I, space, M-H-O. So, a 1,000 ohm resistor, if you use it in series, in the conventional way of talking about it, it's got 1,000 ohms. If you're using it in shunt, and you're therefore talking about conductance, it is a 1 millimo conductor. So a 1,000 ohm resistor in a series circuit, the exact same resistor, you put it in a parallel circuit, so properly analyzing it, you would call it a 1 millimo conductor. It's the exact same resistor. Just that the conductance mathematics in some circuits is a lot easier to handle when it comes to analyzing the circuit. It's got some serial stuff and some parallel stuff, and you're trying to boil it all down to one equivalent circuit. And so most amateurs don't use conductance. It's a pretty rare word. It's the people who are doing theoretical study of a schematic diagram and trying to simplify it, where they're flipping back and forth with complex impedances in an RF circuit. You really get heavy into this jazz if you're doing the impedance matching to a really high power transistor, where the input impedance of the transistor might be, you know, approximately 1.5 ohms of resistance in series with 14 ohms of capacitive reactance. A very difficult thing to match. So you're going to produce all kinds of crazy circuits to try to broadband that and get an impedance match. But the word conductance, transconductance, is what a tube does, because it's you're putting something in and getting something out in a different form. You're putting in volts and getting out current. That's why it's called trans. And what you're getting out is a variable conductance of the tube. It's acting like a variable shunt resistor, a resistor in parallel, and the equivalent resistance inside the tube between plate and cathode. That equivalent resistance is going up and down when you change the plate voltage. And so because you're using it in a parallel circuit, they call it conductance.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because the tube is schematically in parallel with a load resistor and in parallel with your output network, in some cases it's easier to analyze it as a conducting device, a variable conductance device. So it's a transconductance, and most tubes don't conduct anywhere near as good as a 1 ohm resistor. So you don't rate them in mohs, you rate them in millimohs and micromohs. Mostly millimohs, I think, is the value of the transconductance of most of the tubes that I think we've seen. As I said before, it's a whole new set of words in the modern day world, not used as much because we don't use tubes as much. And the first time you hear all this jazz, you're going to say, wow, resistance, impedance, conductance, reactance, susceptance. When is it going to end? K2KY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KY. I know I've had a lot of questions going on and on with this stuff, how one relates to the other. And Dick just said conductance, really, instead of resistance, is very convenient to use sometimes in engineering. I know there's an instances where it was the only way to work out in certain situations. So that instead of using R equals E over I, you use the little G for conductance would equal 1 over R or 1 over E. And trans, basically, as Dick said, it means across. Trans is a Latin word that really means across. So that's basically what we're dealing with, basically the background of why we work with transconductance too. Now, because vacuum tube we're testing, we call that actually mutual conductance of the tube. And that symbol is what you will see in the list of the tube, the specification. You'll see that actually represented by G and a little M, a lowercase G and a little M sort of the side of it. That's known as the mutual conductance. Now you ask how you measure all this stuff. Well, I'll get into that in a minute, but this is what basically you're looking at, what we call the mutual conductance of a vacuum tube. All right, you want to make any comments before I go further, Dick?
Yeah, somebody wants to know how do you test it. You do it with a tube tester. What is the tube tester doing? I think in most cases, a tube tester is putting a small AC voltage on the control grid of the tube using some kind of a known value of plate load resistor to the power supply, supplying voltage to the tube. And now the voltage, AC coupled voltage coming out of the plate of the tube is rectified and it moves the meter. So a tube with higher gain for the same little AC voltage you put on the control grid, you'll get a bigger voltage coming out of the plate because of the so-called transconductance of the tube. And now, in the case of a pentode, that's a nice, easy phenomenon because a pentode tube is almost a constant current device when you fix the voltage on the control grid. In the case of a triode tube, those curves for the tube performance have a slope to them. And now life gets a little bit more complicated. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Okay, go a little slow with this because, again, a little hard to grasp. I know in the first year it is, and I've seen people sit in the class and look at me as if I was speaking some foreign language against a new language. As Dick was just saying, how are we measuring this? What is the poop checker doing? They had poop checkers and they had poop checkers. There were better poop checkers. There were ones in a corner drugstore. For some reason, the pharmacy got into the poop business because they used to have these poop checkers standing there in the corner and sell you poop. They went in the business of selling poop. You come in there, you want a prescription? No, I want to check my poop. So television, something stopped working. You took all the tubes out, put them in a bag, you stood there, and you plugged them into the appropriate shot, and plugged them into the appropriate socket there, and pushed the button, and up came the meter. And what did it do? And what was the difference in the tube checkers, the better ones, the so-called laboratory tube checkers, which there were a number of them. Some of them were very impressive because they had a number of meters on the front panel and a lot of nice little switches that you could turn, buttons that you could push, things that you could slide. So you could sometimes put together about a minute to set up all the different things to test the tube. But what did it do? Let me let it drop. Let Dick make a comment, and then I'll go on and tell you what a mutual conductance tube check and how it works. Over.
You're doing fine. Continue.
Okay, I thought maybe you wanted to make a comment about the tube checkers in the drugstore, over.
Now, I've seen lots of people put all their tubes in the bag, go to the drugstore, check them, and on the assumption the tube checker was telling them the truth, they know which tubes to buy, and a certain percentage of the time it fixed the television set. But there was, as Mel was telling you, there were tube checkers and the tube checkers, the really good ones, the laboratory grade ones. They had a whole bunch of toggle switches. You first rolled the chart to find your particular tube. Then you looked across the various columns of that chart, and it tells you how to set each of the thumb wheel switches, which socket to plug it into, where to set the thumb wheel switches, how to twist the knob to get the right filament voltage, how to twist the knob to get the right AC voltage on the control grid. You didn't know you're doing that, but that's what it told you to do. Twist this knob to number four, set thumb wheel switches or toggle switches to each of these positions. And once you did that all right, you're doing a pretty darn good test of that tube. That was a good tube tester, a little bit on the expensive side. Heathkit sold a tube tester, which I still own, which is not quite that good, but not as bad as the really cheap one. The really cheap one just put a fixed voltage on the filament, a fixed voltage on the control grid, simply measured the plate current and tried to judge good or bad. Well, occasionally you get a gassy tube that draws enough current, and the tube tester thinks it's good, and the tube really ain't very good. So you can be fooled by a really yucky, overly simplistic tube tester. Back to you, Mel.
Exactly. Two cheap tube checkers. like the drugstore, basically what it was doing. It held all the elements of the tubes and basically held them together, tying them together. The only thing that they did have is on what was known as number one grid, they put a fixed AC on that grid, and they you looked at what was happening. The meter was actually in the plate circuit. So that was a kind of way of measuring the transconductance of the tube. That was basically how they did it. And yeah, it gave you a go, no go, especially if you had a set with went out and it had series filaments in there where all the tubes were in series. One of the filaments blew out because that was a common thing, because some of the tubes drew a little bit more current on the filaments than the others, like the horizontal output tubes and all. And that tube would usually, the filament would be the last to go, but some of the smaller tubes in there, the filament light up very bright, extremely bright for a second or two when you first turn the TV set on. And what happened is the filament eventually let go. There was some, yeah, later on they did have a little gadget they were selling, they incorporated, which was supposed to bring up the filament. There was a resistance, really, I guess, as the resistance heated up and then closed the set of contacts. I'm trying to remember how they marked it, what they called that relay. Remember that they think they call it what? The delay, ballast delay or some kind of delay, Dick? It's funny, I don't know why I'm bringing this up now, but just have to think of it over.
Okay, you're right on. There was a BOLO resistor, in other words, there was a negative temperature coefficient resistor on some of these series filament sets, where the resistor in series with all the filaments started off a high number of ohms, and you're putting 110 volts AC across the whole filament circuit, including this BOLO resistor, as they called it. The resistor would slowly get hot, as the resistance would go down, therefore the voltage on the filaments of the tubes was slowly being brought up in a controlled manner, and the tubes would last a lot longer. That's the good news. But that resistor is going through that thermal cycle every time you turn on the set, and pretty soon that resistor doesn't do as much action. It doesn't come down to the right number of ohms, and all the tubes are being starved for the right amount of filament voltage, and the whole set runs kind of dim. And that's what happens downrange, and you got to change that resistor. Another version of it was a time delay relay, which had a heating element inside, where there was a series resistance in series with all the tubes, so that they don't get a big surge of current when you first turn it on. After a certain length of time, the heating element in this vacuum tube-like thing would operate a bimetallic strip, which would bend, close a set of contacts, and now full voltage later on was applied to the filaments of the tubes. One of the things that happened kind of nasty periodically is that your filament voltage on the tubes was part of the 110-volt line. That filament had to be isolated from the cathode of the tube. If the tube developed an internal short between filament and cathode, you've now got a brand new AC voltage on that cathode because it's making direct contact to one of those filament pins. That's bad. The tube tester might not catch that. So you could have a tube that is useless in your set because it's got a filament to cathode short, but the tube tester is not testing for that, and it tells you it's a good tube. You can run into problems like that in the old days. Back to you, Mel, TQLAW.
I just remembered the name of that resistor, Globar. Oh, God, I can't, how these things come back to you. The Globar resistor. All right, anyhow, I don't know why I got off on that curve, that tangent. All right, now getting back to how we test, how the better the tube testers work. They would vary, for instance, the bias on the tube, say, from minus 1 volt to minus 2 volts. Let's just take that as an example. And at the same time, you'd have another meter that was measuring the plate current. So let's say you saw the plate current go, say, let's say from 1.9 mil down to 1.1 mil. So now if you see that, you saw, first of all, you're changing the bias on the tube from minus 1 to minus 2 volts, and you're changing the current from 1.9 mils to 1.1 mils. So you're having a current change of 0.8 milliamps and a voltage change of 1 volt. Now we took these two things and we put it into a little simple formula. What we did, we looked at the meters on these fancy lab tube checkers. We looked at the change in current, the difference in the current from the plate meter. We saw the difference in the change in the voltage. And we used that. We have GM now, that's little g and little m, would be equal to 0.8 mils divided by 1, which would equal 0.8, and we call that milliohm, M-I-L-L-I-M-H-O. Or it was usually indicated by 800, and little symbol micro, little m, and then H-O-M. And you did that with several checks, and you made yourself what they call a transfer curve. And that was called the tube transconductance. I don't know if I can do it any simpler than that, Dick. Over.
Nope, I don't think you can. You got the point across. You got it, Mel.
Okay, it only took me 2 years in Brooklyn Tech to learn that. I thought that's what I'm telling you. It was funny because I remember sitting in a class and listening. Then went home with my head spinning. How am I ever going to understand all this entire terminology and all? So when you first hear it, why try to do it as slow as possible. The first time you hear this stuff, you're just going to go wild. Understanding. I don't want to go any further how to select a plate load and all. Because there's so much more to this. But this is basically what we're doing. This is basically what you call mutual conduction. And the tubes, like you, for instance, a lot of tubes that stick that you're running into, such as popular tubes and all, would have a GM that would be like 2,200, it could be high as 15,000, and it depends on what the tube was, and, you know, actually, the steeper the slope gave it a higher GM. So that's what many of the charts that you see not only give us the GM, but they also give this curve. And the bottom of the curve is the grid fault, and the upper part of the, in other words, this is a curve, you see the curve going, you see the straight line, vertical straight line, with the plate milliamp, while the horizontal line was the grid volt. And you saw for the different grid volts what the plate milliamps were, basically. In other words, it showed you the characteristics of the tube that way. It was a chart, over.
Yeah, there is one other thing called mu of a tube. Mu equals GM over RP. The tube itself, when you change voltage on the grid, which you were calling bias voltage, another way of talking about it, voltage from grid to cathode, that's your input terminal, which in general draws no current. So you're just putting voltage there, and it draws no current. It acts like an open circuit on most tubes in most operations. Not always true for transmitting tubes. We're not going there right now. So a change of grid voltage changes the plate current. But you feed voltage into that plate by putting it through a load resistor, a series resistor between the power supply, positive terminal, goes through a resistor into the plate of the tube. So now you're going to get a change in output voltage on the plate because the tube is changing the amount of current it draws, therefore the voltage drops across that load resistor, as you change the grid voltage. So, in that operation, the net result is a certain change in voltage output for a certain change in voltage input. That was the Greek letter mu. It looks like a funny kind of an M U or M equals GM over RP. So the GM is the rating of the tube in transconductance. The RP is the plate load resistor you are using back to the power supply. So with that silly formula, you could now measure voltage in versus voltage out, real AC voltage gain of the tube, called mu in that particular case. I think we've gone far enough with tubes because they're almost not used anymore, but that mu number is now the gain number you've got for an op-amp. In the case of op-amps, 98% of them are used with voltage in versus voltage out, and many of them have a voltage gain of a thousand to one. Did I say it right? No, million to one. A microvolt of input on a good op-amp will give you a volt of output. Million to one.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's a lot of individual transistors in there doing that. They're all working pretty hard. You take a good data sheet on a modern-day operational amplifier. In many cases, they'll tell you the real schematic diagram of what's inside. And I'll bet you there's some operational amplifiers that have got 10 transistors in there. It's a busy circuit. K2KDY, K2, you're getting a lot for your money. K2KDY, K2RIW.
This is K2KDY. Let me say some final words here. If you've got a radio with tubes in it, and you don't have a tube checker, believe it or not, an experienced technician would be able to troubleshoot the piece of equipment. In those days, we used an instrument that was very popular called a VTVF vacuum tube voltmeter. And with the vacuum tube voltmeter, you would be able to tell, if you were an experienced technician, if that tube was working correctly, so that the VTVF basically properly applied was good, or in many cases better than actually taking the tube out and putting it into a tube check, unless you had one of these very well-made tube checkers. You were better off testing the circuit, understanding the operation of the circuit, and using, I could say, a VTVF at the time, because it did have a very high input resistance. Many people also were able to do it. I used the Simpson 260, which was my favorite VOM at the time, which was a 20,000 ohm per volt meter. And with that, I was able to, in many cases, other than when I was looking for something involving a waveform, of course, where I had to use an oscilloscope. But believe it or not, 99% of the time, I think we did all our testing with a VOM or a VTVM, and were able to determine everything and didn't have to pull tubes out and go testing. All right, I think this is the final words, I think, on this deck. Over.
You hit on a good troubleshooting procedure there, Mel. With that vacuum tube voltmeter, with its 10 mega ohm input impedance, the modern day equivalent is a digital voltmeter, which again has exactly 10 mega ohms input impedance. It's a copy from the old VTVM days. One of the first things you do is measure the voltage from cathode to ground of the tube. Because there was a cathode to ground resistor, if you measured the right voltage, I told you the tube is drawing the right amount of cathode current. If you got a wrong answer there, because many of the schematic diagrams would tell you what is the proper voltage of the cathode on that stage when the thing is operating. If you got the wrong voltage, like too low a voltage, it would suggest the tube doesn't have enough emission, not drawing enough current. But before you made that judgment, you turned the radio off and you measured the cathode resistor. If the color code on the cathode resistor said 150 ohms, and you measured 14 ohms, which happens at times, you know the cathode resistor overheated, partially burned up, went to a partial short circuit condition, has the wrong number of ohms, and so maybe a tube failure, in turn caused a cathode resistor, bias resistor failure. So you would then measure the resistor to be sure you're not getting a false alarm. If the resistor is marked 150 ohms and it measures with your ohmmeter 147 ohms, you say, uh-huh, that's close enough. If there ain't the right voltage there, and if the control grid has got the right voltage, and the plate has got the right voltage, you make a judgment on the tube. So by measuring the voltages of control grid, screen grid, plate, cathode, a smart guy looking at the chart, telling him what voltage should be there, or he's looking at the tube manual, telling him what a typical operating condition. A good technician doesn't have to take the tube out, doesn't have to run down to the drugstore. Right there in his shop with his vacuum tube voltmeter, he makes a whole lot of judgments about various components of the circuit connected to that tube and the tube itself. He can do a lot of analyzing with a little bit of a
repeater, timeout, cancel.
With a little bit of practice on knowing what to look for. First, look for the right voltages. Then look for the right resistor values. Then look for the right power supply voltages. Maybe you start off with power supply voltages first. Remember, I told you, whenever you open up the circuit, the box, on any radio that you're troubleshooting, the very first thing you should do is measure every one of the voltages in the power supply. Are they all right? Because if one of those voltages is wrong, particularly a reference voltage, it will make every circuit in the radio act bad. It'll drive you up a wall. Measure voltages first. Good troubleshooting procedure. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY, yeah. A lot of fun. Did a lot of things that today people will don't appreciate what we back so called good old days. All right, unless you have any final words on good old vacuum toothpick, we'll try something else over.
Yeah, when it comes to low-level circuits like receivers, vacuum tubes are, for the most part these days, very obsolete. Good transistors, properly designed into a circuit, do a much better job, much more compact, much more reliable, work better. But when it comes to transmitters, you're going to see tubes for a long time to come, particularly high-power microwave transmitters. You're going to see vacuum tube devices, whether they be traveling wave tubes, klystron tubes, occasionally triodes, occasionally pentodes. Tubes are going to be around in transmitters for some time. There are tubes like traveling wave tubes that will cover 7,000 megs to 18,000 megs inclusive. The tube has got the right amount of gain and a hell of a lot of power output across all of that 13,000 meg region, 7 gigs to 20 gigs or 7 gigs to 18 gigs. That's 11,000 megs of bandwidth. A traveling wave tube can easily do that. You try to make a solid-state circuit do that, and boy, you're going to spend a lot of money, a lot of time, have a lot of grief, not much reliability, very little bang for the dollar. So a solid-state equivalent of a traveling wave tube, that's a long way off as I see it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Oh, yeah, no doubt, certain specialized tubes, especially the broadcast industry and special use, will be around for quite a while yet because there isn't any kind of simple replacement because of their, in fact, they're also very forgiving nature, like you say, do a lot still with. In fact, I have no qualms about using a transmitter. That I have a couple of them that solid-state circuitry, basically right up to the output with a couple of tubes. Similar like you have a linear amplifier with a couple of final tubes, but I've got 100-watt transmitters that only use the tubes, the transceivers, only as final amplifiers. And I have no qualms about it because I'm not walking around with them. I don't have to worry really that, you know, that the tubes will drag down a battery, because that was one of the real problems. The filaments were drawing a heck of a lot of current, so the battery situation, especially if you do a mobile or whatever, you know, was really a situation that a great deal of your current from your battery was being absorbed up just to light the filament. So, but if it's sitting in a shack, there's a great transceiver, like there were a number of them on the market, like I have columns and all, I don't see any reason that you should, you know, condemn the piece of equipment that would make it say that it's not usable anymore because it's got a couple of tubes in it, Dick, over.
Absolutely. Your transmitter on HF frequency probably has a pair of 6146 tubes in the final, running 100 watts of output. There are lots of good Collins equipment which has a 4X150 or a 4X250B tube in the output. Beautiful external anode ceramic tube, something like 17 or 18 dB of gain, half a kilowatt of output power, can tolerate a short circuit or an open circuit without damaging itself. They're really rugged. So, there are places where tubes do an awful good job. There are very few guys on the 432 megacycle ham band who are running amateur television who are not using tubes. Very few guys are running solid state if they're running high power amateur television, fast scan television. The majority, I think, are using tubes. Very hard to get a solid state equivalent for that kind of linearity, that kind of power output, that kind of survivability of impedance mismatch. So, although solid state has been around now for three or four decades, there are places where tubes are going to be there for a long time to come, as I see it. Probably could go to at least one more, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Who we are, Vic?
Go ahead there, Rich.
I have been listening here and takes me back to the old days. So I just wanted to say, for a ham, you know, you can buy an HF solid-state amplifier, but they're very expensive. Some of the transistors become, after a number of years, become obsolete. But you can't, I'm not obsolete, but unavailable. And then you have to trash the equipment. For a ham, somebody who's not doing this commercially, I mean, something like an Ameritron AL-1500 or AL-1200 or an 8877 or a 3CX-1200 or a big bottle like a 3-500, that's a hard tube to beat because the relative, especially the older glass tubes like the 3500Z, 4-1000A, 3-1000Z, they're relatively inexpensive, they put out tons of power, they're very forgiving. It's very, very cost-effective for a ham.
I certainly agree with that. So, in my transmitters, I think I'm a somewhat modern guy. There are a number of tubes left in some of my transmitters. I bet Mel's got a few, too. Over to you, Mel.
Roger, this is KTKEY. Like I said, I've got a number of Collins radios and all, and they still work excellent, and I've got plenty of tubes in them. I got amplifiers, all the tubes. I haven't got any amplifiers. Got the parts to put together high-powered linear amplifiers, the solid-state, they have modules and all, but never really went that far with them. But as said, I got plenty of them. I got plenty of nice amplifiers around using stuff like 811. Like Dick said, for PX250s and 3CX800s and everything, and no problem with them whatsoever. Gives you a great life and much more reasonably priced right now than a lot of the solid state amplifiers. Okay, shall we try one more, Dick?
Go right ahead.
All right. Here's something, well, we're going to either talk amateur radio fiction or science fiction, or maybe make you a believer. Do you believe Now, this has been a discussion that's been going on in 75 meters, and I knew they're going to start sending me emails on this. Do you believe in long delay echoes?